Well, thank you, Stephen, for that very kind introduction, and thank you all for the opportunity to address you this evening. I think, as Stephen suggested, it's fitting for my final speech in my current capacity as the bank's chief economist to be in front of such a preeminent group of Australia's business economists. I want to talk to you tonight about Australia's economic transition following the end of the resources boom. My focus is going to be on developments affecting broader economic conditions, but also the labour and housing markets more specifically. A key theme of my discussion is that aggregate economy-wide variables, things such as investment, unemployment, housing prices, those sort of aggregates often mask important differences across the states. And understanding those differences can give us a better appreciation of how the economy is performing, how it's likely to evolve. But before I focus on those differences, I'll start with an overview of the overall economy. About 2 weeks ago, we published our updated forecasts. The flow of data over the months prior to that had been broadly in line with our earlier expectations, so our latest forecasts were generally little change from those we put out in August. The economy, it continues to adjust to the end of the resources boom. Our expectation is GDP growth will be close to potential over the next few quarters and then pick up to be just a bit faster than that thereafter. The unemployment rate, which declined a bit more than we had thought over the past year or so, that's likely to edge just a little lower over the next couple of years. And that implies that there'll still be some spare capacity in labour markets for a time. Inflation. Inflation is low. In year-ended terms, we expect underlying inflation to remain around 1.5% for a few quarters before it gradually increases to more normal levels. And that profile for inflation follows from the forecast for the growth of labour costs to rise gradually. It's also consistent with our medium-term inflation target. Now, two key forces shaping developments over recent years have been the large fall in mining investment and commodity prices. Mining investment has a bit further to fall, but by our estimates, about 80% of the adjustment is now behind us. Resource exports, they still have further to grow. Meanwhile, growth of activity in the non-mining sector has risen gradually over recent years, and you can see that in this chart in the top left. That improvement has been fostered by low interest rates, and the depreciation of the exchange rate since 2013 has also been helpful. Growth of non-mining activity, we expect that to be around average over the next couple of years. Now, one notable aspect of our latest forecast was the upward revision to the outlook for Australia's terms of trade. Prices of bulk commodities this year have risen quite a bit, and that's contributed to a rise in the terms of trade of about 6% in June and September quarters. That's the first rise in the terms of trade in some time, as you can see here. Our forecasts are for the terms of trade to remain above the low point reached earlier this year, and about, you can't quite see it in this chart, but about 25% above the average that was there for the early 2000s before the boom kicked off. Now, while our forecasts are uncertain and they're subject to quite a few risks, the upward revision represents a marked change from the pattern of the past few years, in fact, the past 5 years. Our assessment, based in part on liaison information, is that the improved outlook for commodity prices, while it's welcome, it's not likely to lead to a noticeable pickup in mining investment, at least not in the near term. Even so, if our forecasts are right, the terms of trade will shift from being quite a substantial headwind to being, I think what I would describe at this point as being a slight tail breeze, providing some support to growth of nominal demand. So having set that national scene very briefly, I now want to switch attention to these differences across the states. And outcomes across the country have varied in large part because the effects of the end of the resources boom are quite different across different industries. The economy of what I'll refer to as the mining states, Western Australia and Queensland, they've been most directly affected by sizeable declines in mining investment and commodity prices over recent years. Mining investment, it's really intensive in its use of labour. Putting the mining infrastructure in place drew upon workers with a range of construction and engineering skills. That was kind of obvious. But it also employed people with skills we wouldn't normally associate with mining in industries such as business services, in transport, in manufacturing, just to name a few. And many of those people didn't work on site, but they were based in other parts of the state and in some cases beyond the state. Anyway, whether or not they were on-site, off-site, those people were well rewarded for their work on mining-related projects. And in response to those opportunities, there was a large rise in population growth in the mining states. Much of the spending undertaken by these new and highly paid workers found its way into the local economies, further boosting economic activity. So that's the past. The thing is, mining production doesn't require quite as much labour. So it's not been surprising that the shift from the investment to the production phase of the resources boom has seen a decline in the growth of nominal income in the mining states and a sharp decline also in their population growth. Also, the large fall in commodity prices since they peaked in about 2011, that's weighed on mining profits, on wages, on fiscal revenues, and that's all dampened the growth of nominal incomes in the mining states and a bit beyond that as well. At the same time, though, states with less exposure to mining, so New South Wales, Tasmania, Victoria, they've all seen an improvement in their economic conditions. And in Victoria's case, a persistent rise in its population growth. Those states have clearly benefited from the effects of lower interest rates, which has boosted conditions in their housing markets and help support demand beyond that. The decline in the exchange rate since 2013, that's also aided those states' trade-exposed industries, tourism, education, business services and agriculture. South Australia's performance, it lies somewhere between the large mining and non-mining states. And more recently, Queensland, I think it's fared on a few dimensions a bit better than that of Western Australia. In part because the fall in mining investment has been a bit more advanced in Queensland. And in addition, Queensland has the advantage of sizeable exposure to education and tourism industries. So that ranking of the states that I've just mapped out for you then is evident in, amongst other things, the NAB survey of business conditions. So if we go back about 4 years, starting about 4 years or so, surveyed conditions in most states since then have been on an upward trend. They're now generally above average, with conditions strongest in the southeast of the country, as I've described. Western Australia is the obvious exception to that. Conditions there have declined from above average, when mining investment and commodity prices were on the rise, to well below average of late. A similar sort of ranking of economic conditions is apparent in the growth rate of household consumption, shown here. Consumption growth has been generally stronger in the southeast over the past few years and weaker in the mining states. Now, considering those sorts of differences across the states can enhance our understanding of the behaviour of some economy-wide variables, I want to take the example of one of my favourites, non-mining business investment. I think that provides a good example of the value of looking at these differences. So here it is in aggregate form, the line at the top. For the country as a whole, non-mining business investment has been little changed since the onset of the global financial crisis. Prior to that, growth of non-mining business investment had been pretty strong. It averaged about 10% per annum over the 6 years to 2007-2008. It's also increased a little since the peak in mining investment, but by just an average of about 3% per annum. That growth has been less than we might have thought, given the support given to overall demand provided by low interest rates, as well as the depreciation of the exchange rate. And for some time now, we've gone to various... we've had attempts, gone to some length to try and understand why non-mining business investment has been subdued over recent years. And prominent amongst the list of explanations are high level of uncertainty, a low appetite for risk-taking amongst businesses, low productivity growth is another candidate, the growing importance of service industries, which are slightly less capital-intensive. So while such explanations all have some merit, I think there's an additional perspective that becomes apparent once we look at the differences across the states. So what I've done here is I've used the ABS survey of firms' capital expenditure to provide a sense of how non-mining business investment, the aggregate I showed you there, can be broken up across the various states. So these estimates suggest that non-mining business investment has actually been growing over the past 3 years in New South Wales. At what rate? At about 10% per annum on average. Victoria's seen a little bit of growth of late. And the outcomes in those states accord with the bank's business liaison program. Firms in those states appear, some of them at least, willing to invest in response to stronger business conditions. Meanwhile, non-mining business investment has been little changed in Queensland for some years, while it's actually been declining in Western Australia since the peak in the resources boom. So that's broadly consistent with the behaviour of demand across the states that I described earlier. So we can certainly say that non-mining business investment overall has been subdued, but it's not right to say that Australian businesses have been reluctant to invest. Investment has increased to some extent in parts of the country, aided by favourable financing conditions and in response to strengthening demand. But firms have not been willing to increase investment in the mining states and have even reduced investment in Western Australia, where demand's been particularly weak. Let me turn to the labour market. The unemployment rate has declined over the course of this year to be about a half a percentage point below the peak in 2015. However, that decline is likely to have overstated the extent to which extent of the improvement in labour market conditions. That's because over the same period, employment growth has moderated. And part-time jobs have accounted, as you can see in this chart, for all of the growth in employment. Moreover, we're all aware of the fact that the rate of underemployment has increased a little over the past year. So that is, there's been a rise in the share of employees who would like to work more hours than they currently do. So those people represent additional spare capacity. You can get a sense from this chart that a rising share of part-time employment has been a structural feature of the economy for some time. In fact, it's been with us for quite a few decades. And that reflects both demand and supply side factors. But the growth of full-time employment has been quite subdued, at least since 2012. Again, remember, that's when mining investment peaked. Since that time, it's been rising. It's risen only briefly above its 20-year average of 1.3% per annum. Once again, I think the national outcome, though, obscures contrasting experiences across the mining and non-mining states, and that's what this chart attempts to show. During the mining investment boom, full-time employment, if we look at the left-hand panel, full-time employment in red in WA and Queensland grew pretty strongly in the mining states, whereas if you look at the red on the right-hand side for the rest of the country, full-time employment was flat for quite some time. Labour was going to where it was in greatest demand, and it was being paid relatively handsomely in both the mining and the non-mining sectors in the mining states, and I'll show you a chart that makes that point clear in a minute. Since 2012, however, the situation has just reversed itself. Full-time employment in Western Australia and Queensland hasn't increased, and the unemployment rate across those two states has risen noticeably. And I think that makes sense. From 2012, mining investment and commodity prices were in sharp decline. In addition to the retrenchment of mining-related employment, Those sorts of forces have also had a noticeable knock-on effect to non-mining industries in those states, as the buoyant effects of strong growth of the population and of household expenditure have been unwound in concert with conditions in the mining industry. The decline in full-time employment, you can see in red on the top left, over 2016, appears to reflect a further decline in demand conditions within the Western Australian economy. And one important part of that, the property market, has become progressively weaker, and I'll turn to that in a minute. So here's that sense of what was happening to wages in the mining states versus other parts. It does seem that wages appear to be adjusting to bring wage levels back towards those of other states in WA and Queensland. Part of that adjustment's occurring via a decline in wages in the mining sector relative to wages in other sectors. And that's seen in the orange line here. Liaison reports suggest that wage pressures are going to be quite subdued in the mining states for a time. And as that adjustment occurs, it's going to weigh, of course, on the growth of nominal demand in those states. Let me just jump back here and talk about the rest of the country for a moment in terms of employment. So interestingly, full-time employment in the non-mining states remained pretty weak up until about 2014. So you can see this pretty flat spot for some years during the course of the mining boom and then even a bit thereafter. But after 2014, those states have benefited not only from the decline in interest rates, but the positive effect on their tradable industries from the depreciation of the exchange rate that started in early 2013. And the forward-looking indicators for employment, job ads, job vacancies, those various measures, they suggest that employment will grow moderately in the non-mining states in the months ahead, but remain pretty weak in the mining states. Again, like non-mining investment, the aggregate picture of employment masks some pretty important divergences across the states. Now, to a certain extent, the different employment outcomes across the states have been mirrored in the behaviour of unemployment rates, but the population growths also responded to changes in demand conditions in the labour market, which you can see here. So population growth slowed quickly, slowed quickly in the mining states from what had been pretty rapid rates. Some of that slowdown was the natural result of temporary workers who'd helped build the new mining infrastructure, just taking their skills elsewhere, including to other countries, as projects were completed. The other margin of adjustment wasn't so much an outflow of residents from the mining states as it was a halting of the inflow, particularly from New Zealand. In any case, the slowdown in growth of the population in the mining states has meant that the unemployment rates there have gone up by a bit less than would otherwise have been the case. Meanwhile, population growth has picked up over recent years in the southeastern states, in line with the improvement in demand conditions there. Changes in population growth have also had pretty important implications for conditions in the housing market. So let me turn to that topic. Now, as we noted in the latest statement on monetary policy, conditions in the established housing market have eased relative to a year ago. But let me be very clear about this point, because I think there is actually some confusion. They've eased relative to a year ago, but that doesn't mean that the risks associated with high levels of house prices and housing debt have diminished. It does mean that those risks are just not building to the same extent as they were last year. That's because house prices are growing less quickly than they were in 2015. Housing credit growth has also slowed. And importantly, much of that change followed from the earlier actions of the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority and the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, which both led to an appreciable tightening in lending standards. The November statement also discussed some indicators that suggest conditions in the housing market may have strengthened over recent months, though. In particular, housing price growth picked up in Sydney, in Melbourne, and in both those cities, auction clearance rates have increased to high levels. In addition, loan approvals to investors have increased over recent months. But in contrast to Sydney and Melbourne, housing market conditions remain subdued in Perth. prices of apartments, detached dwellings, in Perth have declined further and about 8% below their peak. Rents have fallen by about the same amount in Perth. Those changes are consistent with the weakening in general economic conditions in WA that I've already talked about. Moreover, as this graph shows, population growth in Western Australia has declined significantly since the peak of mining investment in 2012. In fact, that's when population growth peaked there. And yet the full extent of that decline in population growth may not have been readily appreciated by the buyers and the builders of housing there. That would be consistent with the fact that building approvals in WA actually picked up noticeably from 2012 and did not peak until 2014, which was also about the same time that prices and rents reached a peak in Perth. So that meant the housing supply was still ramping up at the same time that population growth was declining. Now, there's quite a bit in this chart, so I'll just take a minute to try and explain it, but the point I was making is apparent here. What I've got is the lines here for each state show the growth in the number of people of each of the large states relative to the number of new dwellings completed at that time. So how many new bodies are coming into the state relative to how many new houses are being built in the state. The dashes just give you a sense of the average number of people per household, which we get from the various census that are done. So that's why they're infrequent. So on average, in most states, 2¾ people per house is about the right sort of number, that the average is the average. In Western Australia, though, that ratio, that orange line, has fallen sharply to about one additional person coming into the state per new dwelling completion. So that's well below that average number of inhabitants per dwelling. In other words, there's lots of dwellings being completed in Perth relative to the needs of the slower growing populace. So that's consistent with the sharp rise in vacancy rates in Perth and the adjustments in rents and prices that we've seen there. It also suggests to me that dwelling construction, construction employment are likely to remain subdued in that part of the world for some time. That's having a knock-on effect to other industries linked to the property market, and these linkages are really just one way in which the decline in the resource sector has been extended and amplified through to other parts of the WA economy. Right, just before concluding, I'll make just a few brief observations on the difference between the strong and rising population growth in Victoria over recent years and the lower population growth in New South Wales. Just remind you of what that is. So Victoria, underlying this, Victoria is now the beneficiary of net inward migration from each of the other states and a larger contribution from net overseas immigration compared with its past and compared with New South Wales currently. And it strikes me, it's just my thought, but it's possible that these contrasting outcomes between Australia's two most populated states owes, at least in part, to a relatively high cost of housing and longer commute times in Sydney. I'm sure many of you can attest to that. Sydney and its surrounding areas. There's some footnotes in the paper that give you a few facts about that, compared with Melbourne. Also, the graphs here suggest, this one, if we go back to the panel for Victoria, the graphs here suggest that the housing supply in Victoria has expanded at a relatively brisk pace, enabling the state to accommodate the relatively strong growth of its population over recent years. Of course, many of these things are determined jointly. They're endogenous. Now, let me draw some conclusions together. In a country as large and diverse as Australia, the behaviour of the economy as a whole often misses important differences across the country. The modest growth of non-mining business investment over recent years, that masks the stronger growth in some parts of the country and declines in others. The weakness in full-time employment nationally over the past few years owes much to the subdued demand for labour in the mining states. And as I've suggested, housing market conditions are far from uniform. Prices are falling in Perth after a ramp up in supply, combined with a sharp fall in population growth. Meanwhile, Melbourne is seeing population inflows that are quite strong, perhaps benefiting from strong growth of supply for some years of housing and lower prices than in Sydney. And these are just a few examples of how the experience of the different states and industries can provide, I think, some useful insights into the behaviour of the overall economy. The bank puts time and resources into understanding those sorts of differences across regions, across industries. We examine a range of publicly available data, and I've suggested we've built on that knowledge through our extensive liaison program. And while the bank sets monetary policy for the nation, an appreciation of the different parts, I think, provides us a bit more confidence about our understanding of the behaviour as a whole. And, as I've said, a key reason for the differences across the states over recent years has been the effect of large declines in mining investment and commodity prices. These have contributed to weaker economic conditions in the mining states and therefore weighed on conditions nationally. But those forces are waning. Indeed, the terms of trade have even risen a bit of late. Hence, I think there are reasonable prospects for stronger growth of nominal demand in the mining states and, by extension, for the economy overall. And that would contribute to a rise in domestic inflationary pressures, a gradual return of inflation to more normal levels. In conclusion, a close examination of the differences across the states, I think, can also help shed some light on the outlook for the Australian economy. So let me finish there, and I think Stephen's going to come up and help direct traffic on the Q&A. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much, Chris, for that very detailed presentation. As Chris said, now we've got the chance to ask some questions that Chris will answer. But there's a microphone here on the on your left and another one over there on the far right. So if you do have a question, please come and approach the microphone and I'll call you out. But if you can please state your name and affiliation, let's keep the questions short to the point and we'll get through as many as possible. So we need a first volunteer to head towards one of the mics.
I can't promise the answers will be short.
This is a...
Roy.
Will this be a question or a statement, Rory?
It's a tradition, so I probably should ask a question. Get the ball rolling. Chris, last week we had a wages report from the ABS that said that private sector wages growth had slowed a tiny bit further, in that the previous six readings were about 0.5% per quarter, and most recently is a 0.4. Maybe that's a meaningful difference, maybe it's not, but the half-year annualised rate is at 1.8. Do you see that as a slight deceleration, or you think that there is a sort of a strong chance that wages growth is in the process of troughing sort of as we speak? And can anyone else in the room confirm that?
Thanks, Rory. Thanks for kicking things off. Yeah, well, I think as you already suggested in your question, it is at this stage just one quarter of slightly weaker WPI growth, having had quite a few quarters where it had been pretty stable, whether it's the total measure or the private sector measure. So I think the thing I'd emphasise, it's one quarter's reading, it's just a modest reduction in that. Obviously, we wouldn't like to see wages fall much further from here or be sustained at much lower levels in terms of wage growth. But it is just one measure. Another much broader measure, but not quite as timely, is from the national accounts. That's done quite the opposite to the WPI in the last couple of quarters' readings. So the average earnings per hour from the national accounts, the growth of that's actually picked up quite a bit. It's a lot more volatile. It may not be sustained, but I don't think it's immediately obvious that we're likely to see a new lower move in wage growth. Only time will tell, of course. But the terms of trade, I think the important point that I made in the speech, the terms of trade have turned from a really significant headwind, those were big falls and largely unexpected, to, I think what at this stage looks like something of a tail breeze. And I think the other thing is our liaison, particularly in the southeastern states, suggests there might be a little bit of pressure emerging on wages, at least in some industries, particularly where there's quite strong demand, and construction, of housing is a really obvious one. So you know, it remains to be seen, but it's not immediately clear. It's one observation. It's a small perturbation.
Anything good forecast for wages in the financial sector?
You're probably closer to that than me, Rory, so I'll leave that one.
Got it, Matt.
Matt.
Matt Sheward from Perpetual Investments. Thanks very much for your presentation, which really has confirmed my long-held suspicion that the amount of sex people have in Australia is positively related to their income growth, which, following on from Rory's question, really is a message to people in the finance services sector to temper their expectations at home. But on a more serious note, one of the hardest things for a central bank to do is obviously manage the inflation target with a flexible exchange rate like we have. You noted in your talk about the rising terms of trade. And if you put spot commodity prices into our trade volumes, we'd move from an average $3 billion trade deficit in the last 12 months to a record trade surplus and a current account balance of less than 1% of GDP, obviously underpinned by China's fiscal expansion. So when you put that combination of a positive trade balance, record low current account for the last 40 years, expanding China and rising terms of trade, when do you think those traditional drivers of our currency will start to have a positive effect on it?
Look, I'm not in the business of forecasting the exchange rate, so I can't answer the thrust of your question. Let me just say that, look, we saw the exchange rate appreciate a little bit over the course of this year, and I think it was reasonable to assume that that was at least in part in response to the turnaround in commodity prices. More recently, we've seen it come back a bit. That's really a strength of the US dollar story more than anything else. But look, we're not really going to be useful as forecasters of the exchange rate. The best forecast, I think, is unchanged. I don't think I can add much more than that.
Well, I wasn't asking for a forecast, but I was thinking, would you expect those forces to have their traditional effects on the currency in the next year?
Well, possibly, but it always depends. It's really hard to tell because, everyone can see commodity prices doing what they're doing already. I think most people are probably predicting that current spot prices for things like coal and iron ore won't persist at these current rates for a number of good reasons. Coal, for example, part of that is China pulling back on the supply. They've encouraged very unprofitable operations to shut down. And perhaps they've overachieved, particularly given some other supply disturbances, and they probably wouldn't like to see these coal prices sustained at these levels. So if they don't fall back, they'll turn the supply back on of their own coal until they get a correction. So if we think commodity prices are going to come back anyway, most people are probably predicting that. The exchange rate should already embed all of that in it today. So it's hard to sort of say things we can predict now that might happen in the future, like a slightly higher terms of trade for quite some time than we have experienced in the past, will lead to a predictable change in the exchange rate in the future. It should be in the price today. So that's why I hesitate.
Yeah, thanks.
Carlos Cacho from CFS GAM. Thank you for a very interesting presentation. You mentioned in the presentation the rise in underemployment we've seen. Mm-hmm. Now, this obviously isn't just an issue in Australia. It's also in the US and UK. I was just wondering if you could give us a bit of colour on how much of this do you think is due to cyclical factors compared to structural changes we're seeing?
I don't know. It's a good question, but I don't really know the answer to that. I think, you know, the structural stuff shouldn't... That's a slow-moving sort of beast. So it shouldn't... It can't be really useful for explaining the past year. At least I don't think so. So you would say, well, maybe the fact that it's held up, risen a little bit while the unemployment rates come down is more a demand-side weakness. You can get a sense of that, I think, if you recognise some of the weakness in employment... particularly full-time employment, has been amongst males. It's been in things like construction, utilities, manufacturing, traditional sort of sectors in terms of employing more men, typically. And I showed you, you know, the full-time employment's been sort of weak in WA and Queensland, which are experiencing these pullbacks in a whole manner of things, including their construction industry. So that sort of gives you a bit of a cyclical story. Having said that, then the other thing that might be useful is to sort of pull the state data apart a little bit more. And the trouble is when I do that, I don't get particularly meaningful answers, and it may just be, it's not that the data is at fault, it's just really hard to pull data, even something as big as the labour force, apart state by state. And just to give you a quick example, so my recollection is New South Wales has had the slightly weaker full-time employment and still some part-time growth. So you might have thought that's where the underemployment rate has gone up. Hasn't gone down in New South Wales. And Victoria's had pretty strong full-time employment. And you'd think, well, that's where the underemployment rate should have gone down. No, it hasn't. It's gone up. So it's hard to pull the data apart too finely. But I think it's a bit cyclical.
Thank you.
Hi, David Lane from Count Financial. Probably the only non-economist in the room. And American, as you can hear from my accent. So the question is, Donald Trump is president. Stephen assures me that everything will be fine. I'm a little bit nervous.
I did not say that.
Curious about your view, or more appropriately, the RBA's view, and what's changed in regard to forecasting based on him becoming the next president.
Yeah, well, I can't give you the RBA view. I can give you my view. I guess my starting point is I sort of just relay a story we were saying over dinner. For a time on the Wednesday, I was at the edge of my seat, but just as an interested global citizen, also I happened to live with five Americans, so they were quite interested in the outcome themselves. I went to lunch, came back, and things had turned pretty quickly. Anyway, at that time I was on the edge of my seat. Ever since, I have not been on the edge of my seat. I think we're alert to these things, but it's just too early to know very much. I think what we do know, at least what the markets have assumed, is he's got a plan and the Congress are likely to support elements of this for some part of a fiscal expansion. We don't know how much and how fast. Potentially that's going to boost growth a bit. It looks like it's helped push inflation expectations up a bit in the US. That's led to a rise in interest rates in at least the longer-term security that's quite noticeable there and around the world, actually. It's had a knock-on effect. So those are not unwelcome things if they come to pass. And then, of course, the key concern, and the governor said this the other week in his Q&A, the key concern for everyone, I think, who watches this carefully, is the possibility of trade restrictions, of some sort of trade war. Anyway, I think what most people are hoping is that people getting closer to those decisions in the US and those who might respond to anything the US might do have some careful reflection, recognise the damage it would do to all parties. We're all involved in trading globally as an important part of our economic activity. So recognising that, they might sort of hopefully not do anything too extreme. But that's the big concern, right? So it's got some pluses and minuses, but I think it's just too early to say. We just don't know.
Thank you.
Steve. Oh, Stephen Walters from the Institute of Company Directors. Chris, thanks from me too for your speech. Your boss, Governor Lowe, was asked in Melbourne last week what keeps him awake at night, and I think he mentioned potential trade wars and protectionism. Given this is your last speech as chief economist of the bank, at least for now, what level or what issue of anxiety would you like to leave for your successor?
Look, I mean, he's right. He's right to be focused as that as the sort of key concern, because it's not just an issue that's relevant to sort of Trump becoming elected. It's much broader than that. You can see the pullback. You know, the UK has sort of said they would like to sort of pull back with a key trading partner and renegotiate that. And there are elements of populism around the globe where that's a key focus of many cries for change. So I think that is a worry, because it's much broader and deep-seated than one person in the president-elect in the US. But look, bad stuff can happen all the time, and I think humans are really good at telling stories about the bad stuff. And as an economist, I often find it challenging to tell stories about good stuff because they're harder stories to tell, and people it's people lose engagement with it. So I think we should recognise, we often say we're in a much more uncertain world, and I think that's just a fallacy. Sometimes we are. You know, GFC was one of those moments. But much of the time it just feels uncertain because we're here in the moment and we're focused on it intently. But it's not entirely clear to me that uncertainty has gone up exceptionally of late. I mean, obviously in markets, some of those sort of measures jumped around a lot around the time of the election, but they've settled down a little bit at least. So uncertainty is the thing that's sort of bad for economic growth and prosperity to a certain degree, but it's a reality, and I don't know that it's particularly high now. So, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that good things happen with the absence of a whole string of really bad things, and that can sort of occur. And people, I think, quickly made that assessment with Trump. They thought the worst. They heard some more conciliatory sounds. They pulled back from that. Then they focused on some of the positives. Markets turned around. So, you know, but the trade is probably the big thing because it's a global sort of phenomenon.
Thought we might have exhausted the supply, so... Oh, no, Rory wants to go for another one.
Mm.
Should we allow that?
Oh, why not, Rory? It's getting close to the end of the year.
Yeah, OK.
Rory Roberts from Westpac Treasury again. This is actually a genuine question, not an attempt to drag out the Q&A session. there was a sort of a mention of underemployment earlier, and there is a sort of a growing focus on underemployment in the Reserve Bank's commentary. My question is sort of how valid is this as an economic variable in that we're adding, you know, the proportion of the labour force that would like a job versus, the, you know, adding to that the proportion of the labour force would like, you know, some more hours, and we add it together as sort of weighting of one for one, I think, and get some large double-digit number, you know, a double-digit number that is concerning. But, you know, is that a valid thing to do? You know, in the olden days, when I was a boy and probably you were a boy, you know, people were concerned about misery index where you added the unemployment rate to the inflation rate and it was basically, you know, 9% inflation plus 8% unemployment and that 17%, that's bad. Now there's 5.6 plus, you know, 1.5 and we're sort of 7 or 8 and, you know, we're wringing our hands that, you know, some people can't find extra hours. You know, should we get a grip and basically say things are actually much better than they were for most of our lifetimes, at least, you know, 70s, 80s and some of the 90s?
Look, I think there's some, you know, there's some parts of that I would very much agree with. It's a bit uncomfortable to just add them together. It's quite alarmist to some extent because you aren't, as you suggested, Rory, taking account of how many extra hours people would like and what they're willing and able to do to get those hours. I think the point we're just making is that over a period where the unemployment rate has come down, if you just looked at that, you'd sort of conclude a noticeable improvement in labour market conditions. But I just think you have to be a little bit cautious about that because the underemployment rate normally would follow it down, maybe not so fast, maybe not quite so much, but it would usually turn with it, and it hasn't. And this has happened at a time, if I go back to this chart, the periods where part-time and full-time employment growth separated here, the last two episodes, one around the GFC and then one around sort of 2013 or so, were periods where the unemployment rate was increasing, and this one is the opposite. The unemployment rate's been increasing even though full-time employment's coming down. So it just sort of says it tempers that sense that the unemployment rate tells us things are getting better, and it suggests maybe there's more spare capacity than the unemployment rate suggests. So you just have to be a bit cautious about that. And ultimately, with time, we'll know that through wage pressures and so on. But only time will tell, again, back to my earlier answer on the wage front.
Thanks very much.
Dr. Kent, Michael Heath from Bloomberg. I just wanted to make the glass half empty again. if the RBA seems to have been looking, or everybody, at reasonably good second quarter growth and the unemployment rate and the 3.3% year-on-year growth, 5.6% unemployment, is that not misleading in a sense when we have such a high level of population growth relative to other countries and we have these resources exports, neither of which involve a lot of employment? And then on the unemployment, we have the underemployment mentioned, but also the participation rate going down a lot. And a few economists have pointed out that if the participation rate was what it was at the start of the year, we'd be at unemployment above 6. So are those headline figures you like to sort of concentrate on a little bit misleading at the moment?
How about I say the standard economist answer, which is yes and no. So, I mean, I think one point you raised in there was resource exports still have a way to grow. So in this graph, that kind of is the mining activity contributions to GDP are the orange bars here, and that's a combination of the resource exports and then taking off, at the moment, mining investment's falling a lot, so it's going the other way. So those orange bars should sort of be in positive territory as mining investment comes, sort of stops being a drag, and resource exports are growing. That'll contribute to GDP growth, but we've said quite explicitly for some time now that that might not be as good as you might think in terms of the implications for the unemployment rate. And that's why I said in my commentary and in our forecasts, and there are fan charts that show this quite clearly in the statement of monetary policy, we expect the unemployment rate at best to edge down a bit, and there's a lot of uncertainty about that. And that's a reflection of, even though GDP growth in our forecast we think will be a bit above potential for a good part of the next couple of years, it won't make big inroads into the unemployment rate because much of that comes from resource exports, not a lot of intensity in terms of labour use for things like LNG. But look to other things that tell you, look, business conditions, except in WA, are above average. We have seen a fall in the unemployment rate that I think is perhaps, you know, if you only had one measure of spare capacity in terms of the labour market, you'd probably want to sort of focus on that. Not the only thing. You mentioned the part rate. I don't have a chart of it, but the big fall in the part rate comes from WA. So we know conditions are weak there, and it's dragging down some of the national averages. And that's why I think it's a really important part of the story is when things sort of bottom out there and turn, and in Queensland as well, Queensland's a bit more advanced. It's doing a bit better than WA at the moment. I think the turnaround in the terms of trade is a big part of that positive story. It's the absence of the drag from the fall in the terms of trade. It's the absence of the drag from mining investment. So it comes back to that earlier point I was making about uncertainty. The absence of bad stuff allows the economies to sort of grow.
Matt's come back. Matt, I'm going to allow you one more question if you keep it questions. Above your hip.
Since June 2009, Dr. Kent, the US economy has expanded 16% relative to an average over the last 23 cycles of 41%. So it's the weakest recovery in history. It's entirely been driven by consumption, yet markets have pinned a lot of hope on this Trump fiscal stimulus. I guess my question to you is, do you believe that the US government's balance sheet has enough room to initiate a fiscal expansion which is large enough and long enough to absorb the excess capacity in the US economy to have businesses start to invest again?
Look, I think the challenge is to know what is the potential growth rate in the US. And, yeah, growth's been weaker than in the past, but potential growth, I think, is weaker than in the past. One aspect of that, of course, that's quite clear and pretty immutable is the demographic change, the ageing of the populace, which is much more advanced there than it is here, not as advanced as in Europe, but it's having a noticeable effect. So that means lower growth of the workforce means lower GDP growth. They've got lower productivity growth as well that they're experiencing. To the extent that the political process can deliver some of the appropriate sort of deregulation that might spur a bit more productivity growth, a bit more innovation, that might help at the margins. But the thing is, if potential GDP growth has been a bit disappointing, but if potential growth has also been disappointing, spare capacity, maybe not so much. And the unemployment rate, I think, is widely recognised in the US as being close to, if not a bit below, full employment now. And you hear a lot of people saying, yeah, but there's no wage pressure. Nominal wage growth is very low. It's not doing much. It's only picked up a bit. It's starting to pick up a bit more, but the thing I would point to is the fact that unit labour costs in the US, and that's what matters for inflation, they're actually above average, quite a bit above average. Why? Because people are the wage growth people are getting in nominal terms isn't especially high relative to the productivity growth. So the inflationary pressures coming from wages are starting to build. So it's not clear to me that there is that much spare capacity in the US.
Thank you.
Dr. Kent, Nick Rutherford from RBC Capital Markets. I'm not sure about you, but one thing that does keep me up late at night, apart from my young children, is Australia's sovereign rating. So in your opinion, what will be the states that fare best or fare worst? Consumer confidence, business confidence, and overall activity, should Australian ratings be affected?
Well, look, I think I think the important consideration when we're thinking about the credit rating really is that underlying that concern is a broader and widely acknowledged need for fiscal consolidation. And the point we've made is not necessary so much in the short term. In fact, that could be counterproductive if it's done too vigorously in the short term. But a credible medium-term plan is needed to balance the desire of spending with the real need to raise revenue to meet that. Public debt's not especially high. Despite the rise in bond yields, debt's still pretty cheap. You can get finance at pretty cheap rates. The other thing I'd note is the UK lost their AAA credit rating. Their costs of borrowing went down shortly thereafter. Confidence is reasonable and holding up in the UK. So is consumption at the moment. That sort of makes sense. People got what they voted for. They feel good about life. I wouldn't make too much of that. The market should have already processed this information anyway. And that's my point about the UK as well. It really didn't seem to have a big effect.
Given the time, we will make this the last question. So over here.
Sophia Rodriguez from MNI. How worried are you about housing oversupply, especially in the speech you're talking about oversupply in Perth, and the fact that in your financial stability review you talked about the need for slowing in housing construction in some parts of the country? And related to that, how confident are you about population growth if the dwelling investment sustains at this level? How reliant will it be on increasing population?
Good and difficult questions. I'll start with the population growth. It's a bit, as an economist, I'd say endogenous, which means it's sort of a bit chicken and egg-like. If conditions are good, the population will come. If the population comes, it might help support good and buoyant conditions in things like the housing market, at least. I think that's certainly what's happening in Victoria. Conditions are better. They managed to produce some supply at prices that people are willing to buy into, and they're certainly a bit cheaper than Sydney, and yet they're living in a major city of Melbourne, which they would say, well, I can get the same lifestyle more or less as Sydney. I say that more or less as a Sydney-sider with a slight bias. But in terms of the oversupply, I think the thing is when you're at real extremes, which is where Perth was, where the population growth had been so strong and people were attuned to that, and then maybe they didn't expect it to stay at the rates it was, but they thought it would be sustained for a time and then built according to that. And as I said, while population growth was slowing quickly, housing supply was ramping up in Perth. And that's a lesson for sort of you've got to be cautious and watch out and recognise that if you're buying into property as a buyer or a developer, you could be doing this at a time where prices might fall, which is fine if you can accommodate that, but it's problematic if you can't. What was said in other cities is that, you know, there's clearly strong demand for housing in Sydney, in Melbourne, and there has been in Brisbane as well. And supply has responded to those higher prices, and that's appropriate, that's what you want. But the concern is about pockets of excess supply in concentrated regions. And we've flagged in some of our publications sort of inner city Brisbane and inner city Melbourne. Now, yeah, there might be places that people would really like to go and live, but maybe they're making too many apartments that's suitable for a very narrow market. And if things soften a bit, alternative buyers might not be so readily willing to come in and buy them off developers or buy them off other people. So that's a bit the concern. Not so much that, you know, supply is coming forth in response to higher prices, but that some of the supply is very concentrated in its locations and the nature of that supply. Thank you.
All right. All that's left for me to do is to ask everybody here to thank Dr. Kent very much for his presentation today and for answering all those questions. Thanks.